Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone and J.A. Johnstone's Savage Texas. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by David Coyne, Danny Gavigan, Michael Glenn, Nanette Savard, Thomas Keegan, Eric Messner, Tim Carlin, Bradley Smith, Dylan Lynch, Drew Kopas, Gary Tells, Michael John Casey, Tim Pabone, David Harris, Nick DePinto, Scott McCormick, Ken Jackson, James Konacek, Richard Rowan, Yasmin Toison, Alyssa Wilmoth, and Mort Shelby. Savage Texas, Book One. Some towns play out and fade away. Others die hard. By midnight, Midvale was ablaze, the light of its burning a fire on a darkling plain. It was a spring night in late March, 1866, the earth quickening as Midvale died. The well-watered grazing lands of Long Valley in north-central Texas supported many widely scattered ranches. Midvale came into being at a strategic site where key trails crossed. The town supplied the needs of local ranchers and farmers for things they couldn't make or grow, but couldn't do without. A cluster of several square blocks of wooden frame buildings, it offered a handful of shops and stores, several saloons, a small cafe, a boarding house or two, and a residential neighborhood. Tonight, Midvale reached its end through a violent passive. The killers ushered it into extinction. Raiders they were, a band of cutthroats, savage and merciless. They came under cover of darkness and fell on the town like ravening wolves, gun wolves. The folk of Midvale were no sheep for the slaughter. The Texas frontier is no place for weaklings. For a generation, settlers fought Comanche, Kiowa, and Lipa and Apache war parties, Mexican bandits, and homegrown outlaws. The battle fury of the recent war between the states had left this part of Texas untouched, but there was not a family in the valley that hadn't given husbands and sons to the armies of the Confederacy. Few had returned. The folk of Midvale were not weaklings, not fools either. They were undone by treachery, by a vicious attack that struck without warning. By the time they knew what hit them, it was too late to mount any kind of defense. Ringing the town, the raiders swooped down on it, shooting, stabbing, and slaying. No fight this. It was a massacre. After the killing came the plunder, then the burning, as Midvale fell to the torch. The scene bloomed into an inferno, as if a vent of hell had opened up, bursting out of the midnight ground in a fiery gusher. The killers hunted down the scant few who'd survived the initial onslaught. All were slain outright, all but the young women and children, boys and girls. Captives are wealth. The church was the last of Midvale to burn. It stood apart from the rest of the town. Modest distance separating it from worldlier precincts. A handful of townsfolk fled to it, huddling together at the foot of the pulpit. That's where the raiders found them. The church was set on fire, its bell tower spire a flaming dagger thrusting into the night-black sky. Wooden beams gave, collapsing, sending the church bell tumbling down the shaft into the interior space. The marauders rode out, well satisfied with this night's work. They left behind nearly 100 dead men, women, and children. It was a good start, but riper targets and richer pickings lay ahead. The war had been over for almost a year, but there was no peace to be found on the Texas frontier. No peace short of the grave. But for the ravagers and pillagers who scourge this earth, the mysterious and unseen workings of fate sometimes send a nemesis of righteous vengeance. From out of the north came a lone rider, trailing southwest across the hill country down into the prairie. A smiling stranger mounted on a tough, scrappy, steel-dust stallion. Man and mount were covered with trail dust from long days and nights of hard riding. Texas is big and likes bigness. The stranger was no Texan, but he was big. He was 6 feet 2 inches tall, raw-boned, long-limbed, his broad shoulders axe-handle wide. A dark brown slouch hat topped a yellow-haired head with the face of a current-day Viking. He wore his hair long, shoulder length, scout style, a way of putting warlike Indians on notice that its owner had no fear of losing his scalp to them. A man of many ways, he'd been a scout before, and might yet be again. The iciness of his sharp blue eyes was belied by the laugh lines nestled in their corners. No ordinary gun would do for this yellow-haired wanderer. Strapped to his right hip was a cut-down Winchester repeating rifle with a sawed-off barrel and chopped stock. A mule's leg, as such a weapon was popularly known. It had a kick that could knock its recipient into the next world. It rested in a special long-sheath holster that reached down from hip to below mid-thigh. Across his torso in an X shape, the stranger wore bandoliers lined with cartridges for the sawed-off carbine. A Green River knife with a foot-long blade rode sheathed on his left hip. Sometime around mid-morning, the rider came down off the edge of the Edwards Plateau with its wooded hills and twisty ravines. Ahead lay a vast open expanse, the rolling plains of north-central Texas. No marker, no signpost noted that he had crossed a boundary, an invisible line. But indeed he had. Sam Heller had come to Hangtree County. Monday noon, the first day of April, 1866. The hot sun topped the cloudless blue sky. Below lay empty tableland, vast, covered with the bright green grass of early spring and broken by sparsely scattered stands of timber. A line of wooded hills rose some miles to the north. The flat was divided by a dirt road running east-west. It ran as straight as if it had been drawn by a ruler. No other sign of human habitation presented itself as far as the eye could see. An ant-like blur of motion inched with painful slowness across that wide, sprawling plain. It was a man, alone, afoot on the dirt road. A lurching, ragged scarecrow of a figure. Texas is big. Big sky, big land. And no place for a walking man. Especially if he's only got one leg. Luke Pettigrew was that man, painfully and painstakingly making his way west along that road to Hangtown. He was dressed in gray, the gray of a soldier of the Army of the Confederate States of America. The Confederacy, now defunct a few weeks short of a year ago, since General Robert E. Lee signed the Articles of Surrender at the Appomattox Courthouse. Texas joined with the South in seceding from the Union, sending its sons to fight in the war between the states. Many fell, never to return. Luke Pettigrew had returned, minus his left leg, below the knee. A crooked tree branch served him for a crutch, a stick with a Y-shaped fork at one end, said fork jammed under his left arm and helping to keep him upright. Strips of shredded rags lay wrapped around the fork to cushion it as best they could. Luke's claw-like left hand clutched the rough-barked shaft with a white-knuckled grip. A battered, shapeless hat covered his head. It was faded to colorlessness by time and the elements. A bullet hole showed in the top of the crown and a few nicks marked the brim. Luke wore the remnants of his uniform. A gray tunic, unbuttoned and open, revealed a threadbare, sun-faded red flannel shirt beneath it. Baggy gray trousers were held in place by a brown leather belt, whose dulled metal buckle bore the legend CSA. Many extra holes had been punched in the belt to coincide with his weight loss. He was thin, half-starved. His garments had seen much hard use. They were worn, tattered. His left trouser leg was knotted together below the knee to keep the empty pant leg from getting in his way. His good right foot was shod by a rough, handmade rawhide moccasin. Luke Pettigrew traveled unarmed, without rifle, pistol, or knife. And Texas is no place for an unarmed man. But there he was, minus horse and gun, and the lower part of his left leg, doggedly closing on Hangtown. Luke moved, powdered head to toe with fine dust from the dirt road. Sweat cut sharp lines through the powder covering his face. Slowly, he advanced step after step with the crutch. How many hundreds, thousands of such steps had he taken on his solitary trek? How many more such steps must he take before reaching his destination? He traveled without a canteen, hobbling a long time without water under the hot Texas sun. Somewhere beyond the western horizon lay Swift Creek with its fresh, cool waters. On the far side of the creek, Hangtown. Luke trudged on ahead. One thing he had plenty of was determination, grit, the same doggedness that saw him through battles without number in the war. Endless forced marches, hunger, privation. It kept him alive after the wound that took off the lower half of his left leg, while others, far less seriously wounded, let life go.
Damn, I'm sick of this walking.
Along came a rider out of the east. Absorbed with his own struggles, Luke was unaware of the newcomer's approach until the other was quite near. The sound of hoofbeats gave him pause. Halting, he looked back over his shoulder. The single rider advanced at an easy lope. Luke walked in the middle of the road because there the danger of rocks, holes, and ditches was less than at the sidelines. He didn't relish spending more of his meager reserves of energy in getting out of the way. He angled toward the left-hand side of the road. It was a measure of the time and place that he unquestioningly accepted the likelihood of a perfect stranger riding down a crippled war veteran. The rider was mounted on a chestnut horse. He slowed the animal to an easy walk, drawing abreast of Luke, keeping pace with him. Luke kept going, looking straight ahead, making a show of minding his own business in hopes that the newcomer would do the same.
Howdy.
At least he ain't no damn Yankee.
Not that that made much difference. His fellow Texans had given him plenty of grief lately.
Yep.
Long way to town.
Sounds friendly enough, for whatever that's worth.
Room up here for two to ride.
Well, I'm getting along, thanks.
Luke did not want to be beholden to anybody. The sound of the stranger's laugh raced like wildfire along Luke's strained nerves.
You always was a hard-headed cuss, Luke Pettigrew.
What?
Luke, stunned, looked to see who called out his name. The rider looked about his age, in his early 20s. He still had his youth, though, what was left of it. Unlike Luke, who felt himself prematurely aged, one of the oldest men alive. Luke peered up at him. Something familiar in the other's tone of voice. A dark, flat-crowned, broad-brimmed hat with a snakeskin hatband shadowed the rider's face. The sun shone behind him in Luke's eyes. Luke squinted, peering, at first unable to make out the other's features. The rider tilted his head, causing the light to fall on his face.
Good God! Johnny Cross!
Long time no see, Luke.
Well, I'll be a good to God damned. I never expected to see you again. Huh. So you made it through the war?
Well, it looks like. And you too.
You mostly.
Luke indicated with a tilt of his head and a sour twist of his mouth his missing lower leg.
Reckon we're both going in the same direction. Climb on up.
Gripping the saddle horn with his right hand, he leaned over and down, extending his left hand. He was lean and wiry, with strength in it. He took hold of Luke's right hand in an iron grip and hefted him up, swinging him onto the horse behind him. It helped that Luke didn't weigh much.
I want to keep hold of this crutch for now.
I'll tie it to the saddle, leave you with both hands free.
Johnny used a rawhide thong to lash the tree branch in place, out of the way. A touch of Johnny's boot heels to the chestnut's flanks started the animal forward.
Much obliged, Johnny.
Well, you'd do the same for me.
What good did that do? I ain't got no horse.
Man, things must be tough in Hangtree County.
Like always. Only more so since the war.
Johnny Cross was of medium height, compact, athletic. He had black hair, and clean-lined, well-formed features shaped his three-day beard-stubbled face. His hazel eyes varied in color from brown to yellow, depending on the light. There was something cat-like about him, with his restless yellow eyes, self-contained alertness, and lithe, easy way of moving. He wore a sun-bleached maroon shirt, black jeans, and good boots. A pair of guns rode strapped to his hips. Good guns. Luke noticed several more things right off. Johnny Cross had done some long, hard riding. His clothes were trail-worn, dusty. His guns, what Luke could see of them in their holsters, were clean, polished. Their inset dark wooden handles were smooth, well-worn with use. He carried a late-model carbine, sheathed in the saddle scabbard. The chestnut horse was a fine-looking animal. Judging by its lines, it was fast and strong with plenty of endurance, the kind of mount favored by one on the Dodge. One thing was sure, Johnny Cross was returning to Hangtree in better shape than when he left it. The Cross family had always been dirt poor, honest but penniless. Throughout his youth, up till the time he went off to war, Johnny wore mostly patched, outgrown clothes and ran shoeless for long periods of time. Johnny Cross handed over the canteen.
Here, Luke, cut the dust some.
Don't mind if I do, thanks.
Luke fought to still the trembling in his hands as he took hold of the canteen and fumbled open the cap. The water was as warm as blood. He took a mouthful and held it there, letting the welcome wetness refresh the dust dry inside of his mouth. His throat was so dry that at first he had trouble swallowing. He took a couple of mouthfuls, stopping, though still thirsty. He didn't want to be a hog or show how great his need was.
Yeah, thank you kindly.
Luke returned the canteen.
Sorry I don't have something stronger.
No, that's plenty fine.
Been back long?
Yeah, since last fall.
How's your folks, Luke?
Your pa got drowned 2 years ago trying to cross the Liberty River when it was running high at flood time.
Oh, sorry to hear that. He was a good man.
Hard-working and God-fearing, for all the good it done him.
Your brothers?
Finn joined up with Ben McCullough and got killed at Pea Ridge. Peck got it in Chickamauga.
That's a damn shame. They was good old boys.
The war killed off a lot of good old boys.
Ain't it the truth?
The two were silent for a spell.
Sue Ellen's married to a fellow over at Denison Way. Got two youngins, a boy and a girl. Named the boy after Pa. Yeah, Ma's living with him.
Imagine that. Last time I saw Sue Ellen, she was a pretty little slip of a thing. Now she's got two youngins of her own.
Johnny shook his head.
Time sure does fly.
Yeah, 4 years is a long time, Johnny.
How was your war, Luke?
Oh, I've been around. I was with Hood's brigade.
Oh, good outfit.
We fought our way all over the South. I reckon we was in just about every big battle there was. I was with them right through almost to the finish at the front lines of Richmond. Till a cannonball took off the bottom part of my leg.
That must have hurt some.
Well, it didn't tickle. Yeah, they patched me up some in a Yankee prison camp where I sat for a few months until after Appomattox in April of 65 when they set us all loose. Well, I made my way back here. Walking most of the way. Well, what about you, Johnny? It seems I heard something about you riding with Bill Anderson.
Oh, did you? Well, you heard right.
Hard riding, hard fighting Bill Anderson led a band of fellow Texans up into Missouri to join up with William Clark Quantrill, one-time schoolteacher turned leader of a ferociously effective mounted force of Confederate irregulars in the border states. The fighting there was guerrilla warfare at its worst, an unending series of ambushes, raids, flight, pursuit, and counterattack. An ever-escalating spiral of brutalities and atrocities on both sides.
We was with Quantrill.
How was it?
We gave those Yankees pure hell.
Johnny's alert, yellow-eyed gaze turned momentarily inward, bemused by cascading memories of hard riding and hard fighting. He tossed his head as if physically shaking off the mood of reverie and returning to the present.
Didn't work out too well in the end, though. After Bill's sister got killed, Bill went off the deep end. She and a bunch of women, children, and old folks was being held hostage by the Yanks in a house that collapsed on him. He always had a mean streak, but after that, he went plumb loco, kill crazy. That's when they started calling him Bloody Bill.
Were you at Lawrence?
Lawrence, Kansas, longtime abolitionist center and home base for Jim Lane's Redlegs, a band of Yankee marauders who shot, hanged, and burned their way through pro-Confederate counties in Missouri. In retaliation, Quantrill led a raid on Lawrence that became one of the bloodiest and most notorious massacres of the war.
It wasn't good, Luke. I came to kill Yankee soldiers. This business of shooting down on our men and boys, it ain't sporting.
No more than what the Redlegs done to our people.
I stuck with Quantrill till the end, long after Bill split off from him to lead his own bunch. They're both dead now, shot down by the Bluebellies. I'd appreciate it if you keep that to yourself. The Federals still got a grudge on about Quantrill and ain't too keen on amnestying any of our bunch.
You one of them pistol fighters, Johnny?
I'm like you. Just another Reb looking for a place to lie.
Well, you always was good with a gun. I see you're toting a mighty fine-looking pair of the plow handles in that gun belt.
That's about all I got after 4 years of war. Some good guns and a horse.
Johnny cut an involuntary glance at the empty space below Luke's left knee.
Not that I'm complaining, mind you.
Well, hold on to them guns. Keep them close. Now that you're back, you're gonna need them.
Yanks been throwing their weight around?
Luke shook his head.
Nah, it ain't the Yanks that's the problem. Well, not yet, anyhow. They's around some, but they're stretched kind of thin. There's a company of them in Fort Pardee up in the breaks.
I thought they closed that at the start of the war, along with them forts up and down the frontier line.
It's up and running now, manned by a company of Bluebelly horse soldiers. Yeah, but that ain't the problem. Not that I got any truck with a bunch of damn Yankees.
Of course not.
What with no cavalry around, and most of the menfolk away during the war. No home guard, no ranger companies. Things have gone to rot and ruin hereabouts. The Indians have run wild, the Comanches and the Kiowas. Comanches, mostly. Watonka's been spending pretty much half the year riding a warpath between Kansas and Mexico. Sometimes as far east as Fort Worth and even Dallas.
Watonka? That old devil ain't dead yet?
Full of piss and vinegar and more ornery than ever. And then there's Red Hand.
I recollect him. A troublemaker, a real bad'un. He was just starting to make a name for himself when I went north.
Well, he's a big noise nowadays, Johnny. He got himself a following among the young bucks of the tribe. Red Hand's been raising holy hell for the last 4 years with no army or rangers to crack down on him. You know, there's some other smaller fry, but the two of them are real hellbenders. But that's not the least of it. The Redskins raid and move on, but the white bad men just set. The country's thick with them. Thicker than flies swarming a manure pile in a cow pasture on a hot summer day. Deserters from both armies, renegades, outlaws, Comancheros selling guns and whiskey to the Indians, back shooters, women killers, the lowest. Bluecoats are too busy chasing the Indians to bother with them. Folks are so broke, there ain't hardly nothing left worth stealing anymore, but that don't matter to some hombres. He's up to all kinds of devilments out of pure meanness. Hell, I got robbed right here in this road not more than a day ago, in broad daylight. I didn't have nothing worth stealing, but they took it anyhow. It'd have been different if I had me a six gun, or a good double barrel sawed off.
Who done it, Luke?
Well, I'll tell you. First off, I've been living out at the old family place, what's left of it. Somebody put a torch to it while I was away. Burned down the ranch house and the barn.
Yanks?
Nope. Federals never got to Hangtree County during the war. Probably figured it wasn't worth bothering with. And all the ranch must have been burned up by some no-goods, probably just for the hell of it. Anyhow, I've scrounged up enough unburnt planks and shards to build me a little shack, and I've been living there since I come back. Place is thick with maverick cattle, the whole range is. Strays had done gone wild during the war. Now there's hundreds, thousands of them running around loose. Every now and then I catch and kill me one for food. I'd have starved without. I had me some hides I'd cleaned and cured, and I was bringing them into town to sell or barter them at the general store. Some fish hooks, chaw tobacco, seeds.
And whiskey?
Hell yes. I had my old rifled musket and mule. I never made it to Hangtown. I got held up along the way. Bunch of no-accounts come up, got the drop on me. 5 of them.
Who?
Strangers. I never seen them before. But when I see them again, well, yeah. Never mind about that now. Lots of outsiders horning in around here lately. I ain't forgetting a one of them. Led by a mean son named Monty.
Monty.
Johnny committed the name to memory.
That's what they called him, Monty. Big old boy with a round fat face and little piggy eyes. Corn silk hair so fine and pale it was white. Got him a gold front tooth a-shining and sparkling away in the middle of his mouth. Yeah, him and his crowd gave me a whomp and busted my musket against a tree. Shot my poor old mule dead for the fun of it. Busted my crutch over my head. It hurt, too.
Luke took off his hat, pointing to a big fat lump in the middle of his crown.
That's some goose egg. Like I said, you always was a hard-headed fella. Lucky for you.
Yeah, lucky.
Luke put his hat back on, gingerly setting it on his head.
While I was out cold, they stole everything I had. My hides, my knife, even my wooden leg. Can you beat that? Stealing a man's wooden leg. Them things don't grow on trees, you know. Well, that's what really hurt. I walked from hell to Texas on that leg. You sure could say I was attached to it.
Well, you could. I wouldn't.
Now, when I come to, them owl hoots was talking about if they should kill me or not. The only reason they didn't gun me down on the spot is because Monty thought it would be funny to leave me alive to go crawling across the countryside.
Yankees?
Hell no, it was Southerners just like us. Texans, some of them, from the way they talked.
His face set in lines of grim determination.
I'll find him. I got time. And when I do, I'll even up with him. And then some. That gold tooth of Monty's is gonna make me a good watch fob once I get me a watch.
He waved a hand dismissively, shooing away the topic as if it were some troublesome insect.
Not that I want to bother you with my troubles. And I'm just giving you the lay of the land, so to speak. And you, Johnny, what are you doing back here?
Johnny Cross shrugged.
I came home for a little peace and quiet, Luca, that's all.
Well, you come to the wrong place.
And to lay low. Border states ain't too healthy for any Quantrill's crowd.
You wantin', Johnny?
Not in Texas. Well, not in this part of Texas.
Yeah, you could do worse. Hangtree's a big county with lots of room to get lost in. The Yanks are quartered 40 miles northwest at Fort Pardee in the Breaks. Well, they don't come to Hangtown much, and when they do, it's just passing through. They got their hands full chasing Indians.
They catch any?
Well, from what I hear, they gotta look sharp to keep the Indians from catching them.
Good, that'll keep them out of my hair.
Now, what are your plans, Johnny?
One thing I know is horses. Mustang still running at Wild Horse Gulch?
More now than ever, since nobody's rounding them up during the war.
Figured I'd collect a string and sell them. Folks always need horses, even in hard times. Maybe I'll sell them to those bluebellies at the fort.
Oh, you wouldn't.
Gold's gold, and the Yanks are the ones that got it nowadays.
Something in the air made him look back. A dust cloud showed in the distance east on the road, a brown smudge on the lip of the blue bowl of sky. Johnny reined in, turning the horse to face back the way they came.
Company's coming.
Well, generally that means trouble in these parts.
Ain't necessarily so, but that's the way to bet it.
Johnny Cross unfastened the catch of the saddlebag on his right-hand side, reaching in and pulling out a revolver. A big .44 front-loading cap and ball six gun like the ones worn on his hips. New, clean, and potent.
Here, Luke.
Luke hesitated.
Take it.
Luke took it. The gun had a satisfying heft and balance in his hands.
Six gun? Whoa, one of them repeating revolvers.
Know how to use it?
After 4 years with Hood's Brigade?
In that case, I better show you how it works then. I wouldn't want you shooting me or yourself by accident.
Shucks, you're joshing me.
I am? That's news to me.
You're still doing it, dang you.
Johnny Cross flashed him a quick grin, strong white teeth gleaming, laugh lines curling up around the corners of his hazel eyes. A boyish grin, likable somehow, with nothing mean in it. Sure, Johnny was funning Luke. Hood's brigade of Texans was one of the hardest fighting outfits of the Confederacy, whose army had been distinguished by a host of fierce and valiant fighters. Johnny turned the horse's head, pointing it west, urging it forward into a fast walk. Luke stuck the pistol into the top of his waistband on his left side, butt out.
It's good to have something to fill the hand with. I've been feeling half-naked with that one.
With what's left of that uniform, you are half-naked.
How many more of them ventilators you got tucked in them saddlebags?
Never enough.
You must have been traveling in some fast company, Johnny. I heard Quantrill's men rode into battle with a half dozen guns or more. Is that true?
And more. Reloading takes time. Fella wants a gun to hand when he wants it.
Man, what we could have done with a brace of these for every man in the old outfit.
Yeah, if only.
Johnny's eyes shone hard, cold. A couple of hundred yards farther west, a stand of timber grew on the left side of the road, a grove of cottonwood trees. Luke looked east. A brown dust cloud grew.
Fair amount of riders from the dust are kicking up. They're coming pretty fast, too.
Wouldn't it be something if that was the bunch who cleaned you out?
Oh, it sure would. Any chance it's somebody on your trail, Johnny?
I ain't been back long enough.
Yeah, don't you feel bad about it, Hoss. It's early yet.
Johnny Cross turned the horse left off the dirt road and into the cottonwood grove. The shade felt good, thin though it was. The Texas sun was plenty fierce, even at the start of spring. Sunlight shining through spaces in the canopy of trees dappled the ground with a mosaic of light and shade. A wild hare started springing across the glade for the cover of tall grass. Johnny took the horse in deep behind the concealing screen of brush.
We'll just let these rannies have it right away so we can get a look at him.
Johnny, if it is that pack that tore into me, Monty is mine.
Whoa, boy. Don't go getting ahead of yourself, Luke. Even if it is your bunch, especially if it is, don't slow down on them without my say-so. They'll get what's coming to them, I promise you that. But we'll pick the time and place. Two men shooting off the back of one horse ain't the most advantageous layout for a showdown. I know you got a hard head. Beware of a hot one. Should have cooled some after 4 years of war.
Well, it ain't. Not for scallywags like them.
Me neither.
The blur at the base of the dust cloud sweeping west along the road resolved itself into a column of riders. About a dozen men or so. They came in tandem. Four pairs in front, then the wagon, then two horsemen bringing up the rear. Hard-bitten men doing some hard traveling, as indicated by the trail dust covering them and the sweat-streaked flanks of their horses. They wore civilian clothes, broad-brimmed hats, flannel shirts, denim pants. Each rider traveled armed with a holstered sidearm and a carbine in a saddle scabbard. A team of six horses, yoked in tandem, drew the wagon. Two men rode up front at the head of the wagon, the driver and a shotgun messenger. A freight wagon with an oblong-shaped hopper. It was 10 feet long, 4 feet wide, and 3 feet high. A canvas tarpaulin tied down over the top of the hopper concealed its contents. Crates, judging by the shape of them under the tarp. The column kicked up plenty of dust. The driver wore his hat teamster style, with the brim turned up in front. The men of the escort rode hard-eyed, grim-faced, and wary. They glanced at the cottonwood grove, but spotted no sign of the duo on horseback. They rode on, dragging a plume of brown dirt in their wake. It obscured the scene long after its creators departed. Some of the dust drifted into the glade, fine powder falling on Johnny, Luke, and the horse. Some dust got in the chestnut's nostrils. Johnny took a swig from his canteen to wash the dust out of his mouth and throat, then passed the canteen to Luke.
What do you make of that?
You tell me.
You're the one who's been back for a while.
I never saw that bunch before. But I don't get into town much.
Well, they was loaded for bear.
Yeah, they must have been Yankees.
How can you tell? They don't wear signs, Luke.
Well, they looked like they was doing all right. Well fed, good guns and mounts, clothes that wasn't rags. The only folks getting along in these parts are Yankees and outlaws. And they was escorting a wagon, doing a job of work. Outlaws don't work. So they must be Yanks. Damn their eyes.
Could be.
Well, they got the right idea, though. Nothing gets nowhere in Hangtree less than it's well guarded. I wonder what was in that wagon.
Yeah, I wonder.
Johnny Cross stroked his chin. A hard, predatory gleam came to his narrowed eyes as they gazed in the direction of the retreating convoy. The wagon and its mounted guards rode west toward Hangtown. Ahead lay a ridge running north-south. It met the road at right angles. The ridge was long, low, and rounded, blocking the view of the landscape beyond. The convoy came to a halt. A rider left the others and went on ahead. A scout named Dawkins, round-shouldered and beefy. Watery blue eyes bracketed his turnip-shaped nose. He climbed the east side of the slope, cresting the ridge and stopping. The slope tilted down into a wide, flat trough with a water course running through it. The water course ran parallel to the ridge. This was Swift Creek. Winding out of the northern hill country, it ran south across the valley. A dirt road descended the west slope of the ridge to the creek. Here the creek ran fast and deep. It could have passed for a fairly respectable-sized river. The shallow valley was marshy bottomland, tree-lined on both banks by willows and cottonwoods. On both sides, the water's edge was thick with brakes and rushes.
Nice country for an ambush.
On the far side of the creek, a long, gentle slope rose to a tree-top table. The road climbed the hill and disappeared into the trees. Several miles beyond, screened from view by the brush, lay the town of Hangtree. A wooden plank bridge spanned the river. Flat Bridge, it was called. Only it wasn't there anymore. A hole gaped where the center of the span had been, showing only fast-flowing blue water. This gave Dawkins pause.
What happened to the bridge?
He took off his hat and scratched his head. His skin was shiny with sweat. He used the hat to fan himself.
Only one way to find out.
He put his hat back on and rode downhill. On the near side of the creek, on the left-hand side of the road, stood a grove of willow trees, their boughs yellow-green. The grass was dark green, the creek sapphire, the sky turquoise. Under the willow trees in the shade were a man and a horse. The man sat near the horse where it stood tied to a tree, browsing contentedly on new green shoots and leaves. The man sat on a fallen tree trunk, smoking. He stood up, facing Dawkins. The smoker wore cavalry blue and held a rifle at his side, muzzle pointing at the ground. He stood there waiting as Dawkins approached. The scout halted a few paces away. The two men eyed each other. The cavalryman broke the silence.
You looking for something, mister?
Yeah, the bridge.
It ain't here no more.
I can see that. What happened to it?
Comanches.
Huh?
Dawkins couldn't help but give a start. He tensed, stooped shoulders, hunching as if anticipating a heavy blow. His eyes widened, trying to see everywhere at once. No Comanches were to be seen. Dawkins got a grip on himself after that first rush of belly-nodding terror, pure and instinctive. He knew what the Comanches could do, particularly to any poor bastard unlucky enough to get taken alive by them. Sense returned. If Comanches were anywhere around, the soldier would hardly be sitting under a tree. He'd be making tracks for somewhere else, pronto. The trooper looked like a tough customer. He had a good size on him, blotting out a fair amount of landscape. A hogshead barrel torso with sloping shoulders and thick arms was supported by a pair of squat bow legs. A short-brimmed cavalryman's cap perched at a jaunty angle on the back of his pumpkin head. Thick, curly black hair lay cut close to the scalp, topping a gargoyle face. A blue uniform tunic with dull brass buttons lay draped over a broken branch projecting from the fallen tree. The trooper wore a brick-red flannel shirt, sleeves rolled up past the elbows. His gun belt was worn low on his right hip, pistol facing butt out in its holster, cavalry style. Its top flap hung unbuttoned for quick and easy access. In his massive paw-like hands, the rifle looked like a carbine. His blue pants bore the yellow vertical side stripes of the cavalry. They were tucked into the tops of knee-high brown leather riding boots. An ugly, powerful brute, thought Dawkins, a bull of a man. Reassuring to have around when the Comanches were on the warpath.
You must be the man I'm looking for. I'm Dawkins, out of Fort Walters, with the wagon.
I don't see no wagon.
It's on the other side of the hill. They sent me on ahead to meet up with our escort, a patrol from Fort Pardee.
The cavalryman was silent.
Oh, where is it? The escort from Fort Pardee.
You're looking at it.
Eh? What's that you say?
The rest of the troop is way to hell and gone, scouring the countryside in search of a war party of Comanche bucks.
The cavalryman leaned his rifle against the fallen tree, and he pulled on his tunic. It was several sizes too small for him, bursting at the seams. The sleeves were each blazoned with a set of sergeant's stripes. He didn't bother buttoning up. He went to Dawkins.
I'm Sergeant Sales from Fort Pardee. If you was an officer, they wouldn't have sent you on ahead. You ain't, so I won't bother to salute.
Reaching into his side pocket, the non-com pulled out a sheet of notepaper, folded into a square, and held it out to Dawkins.
Here's my orders.
Dawkins took the document, eyeing it. It was topped by a U.S. Army letterhead and stamped with the seal of the commanding officer of Fort Pardee. It bore a handwritten note. Dawkins squinted blearily at it.
Looks okay to me. Of course, I can't read too good.
Dawkins returned the document to the sergeant.
Give it to Lieutenant Greer. He's heading up this detail.
How many are you?
12, counting the driver and shotgun rider.
Damn, that's all?
Lucky to get that many. We're stretched so thin at Fort Walters. Nobody knew we were going to run smack into a Comanche rampage.
What do you think we're doing up in the breaks? Practicing parade ground drill? We got Comanche war parties coming and going. Kiowas and Lipan Apaches, too.
Lieutenant Greer ain't gonna like this. He's a green shave tail on his first posting out west.
The sergeant shrugged his massive shoulders, further straining the already overstressed fabric of the tunic.
Tough.
He crossed to his horse, sheathing the rifle in its saddle scabbard. Untying the reins, he gathered them up in one hand and swung into the saddle. He moved alongside of Dawkins.
Let's go.
A word to the wise. The lieutenant's kind of a stickler for army discipline, soldierly deportment and whatnot. You might want to spruce up some before meeting him.
Me? What about you? Hell, you ain't even in uniform.
That's different. The wagon guard detail's all in civilian clothes to call less attention to the mission.
Well, Comanches will lift your scalp all the same if they catch you. When that first Louis of yours finds out how things lay, he'll change his tune pretty damn quick.
Well, maybe, but I doubt it.
The convoy stood waiting on the other side of the ridge at the foot of the eastern slope. The men were at ease, taking a break, though watchful and wary. The sun perched at its zenith, hot. Some of the men idled in the shade, what shade there was to be found, smoking, sipping warm water from their canteens, chatting low-voiced. The sergeant had shaped up to some extent before meeting Lieutenant Greer. His cap was screwed on tight to the top of his head. He and Dawkins dismounted, handing the reins of their mounts to a horse holder. Dawkins led the way. Their arrival, rather that of the single solitary non-com, sparked muted interest among the detail, whose members stared in frank, open curiosity. They were trail-worn and weary, but looked spruce compared to the sergeant. Lieutenant Greer had brown hair, dark eyes, and a well-trimmed mustache. He was in his early 20s, still shiny and fresh-faced. The Texas sun, not yet having baked all the youth out of him. He looked like a schoolboy beside burly, brutish Sergeant Ben Sales.
This here's Lieutenant Greer.
Dawkins sidestepped out of the scene. The sergeant managed to pop a stiff-backed brace and fire off a sharp salute at the young first lieutenant.
Sergeant Sales, reporting for duty, sir.
Greer returned the salute.
As you were, Sergeant.
Sales handed him the document he'd early shown to Dawkins. Greer studied it. It seemed in order. It was a handwritten note from Captain Ted Harrison, commander of Fort Pardee, identifying the bearer as Sergeant Sales, heading the troops detailed to escort the convoy the rest of the way to the outpost.
Where are your men, Sergeant? Securing the bridge?
That's a problem, sir. The bridge is wrecked and my men are off chasing the Comanches who did it.
Greer's eyes looked ready to pop. Catching himself, he scowled, narrowing them. Sergeant Sales explained that a Comanche war party was running riot in Hangtree County, that they'd destroyed the bridge, and that Swift Creek was too fast and deep to allow for a crossing. Greer's flushed face reddened, his lower lip quivering in anger.
How can that be? I was told that the Comanches wouldn't start raiding south of their home grounds for another month or two.
Well, I'm afraid they ain't holding the schedule this year, sir. Comanches is like that. Ornery. Notional.
Greer scrutinized the other man for some hint of mockery or insubordination. The sergeant kept a poker face.
Tonka, he's the big man of the Comanche war chiefs.
Yes, I know who he is. I am not totally uninformed about local conditions. Go on, man.
The war between North and South never quite registered on the savages out here. They got the crazy idea that it was them that caused the army to pull up stakes back in 61 and abandon the line of forts along the frontier that was keeping them red devils in check. Comanches don't know or won't believe that the troops were being pulled back east to put down the rebs. They figure they got us on the run. Now, Wetonka aims to finish the job. He wants all the whites pushed back off the plains, leaving them free and clear like they used to be. He and his bucks started their killing and burning early this year. They hit hard 2 weeks ago farther south, wiping the town of Midvale off the map. A few nights ago, they struck below the South Fork of Liberty River, hitting some ranches, raping, raiding, killing. We don't know if it's the same bunch that sacked Midvale or if this is a whole other war party. They tore up the bridge across Swift Creek to slow pursuit. I sent my men after them and stayed behind to guide you to the fort.
You decided? But that's a violation of orders. Dereliction of duty. Your mission is to escort this detail to Fort Pardee.
Sales remained blandly, patronizingly composed in the timeless mode of veteran soldiers explaining the facts of life to green, untried junior officers.
Begging the lieutenant's pardon, but that just ain't so. Standing orders from Captain Harrison and the district military commandant is that we're charged to fight and kill the savages and protect the civilian population. That mission trumps all others.
Under trail dust, Greer's face blazed red.
If there's one thing I detest, it's a barracks room lawyer, Sergeant.
I'd be facing a court-martial if I disobeyed Captain Harrison and missed the chance to take some Comanche scalps, sir.
Don't be too sure of that, Sales. You may be facing that court-martial sooner than you think.
It's the lieutenant's privilege to prefer charges once we reach Fort Pardee, if we reach it. If the Comanches knew what this wagon is carrying, they'd ride hell-bent for leather to have it. By sending my men after them, I took the initiative, buying us some time.
All very well and good, Sergeant. But the bridge is out, remember? And according to you, Swift Creek is too fast and deep to ford.
Yes, sir. It is here. But several miles upstream, the creek widens out. We can cross at Mesa's Ford and strike out west along the old mission trail, then angle northwest through the breaks to the fort.
All right, then. Very well, Sergeant. We move out now.
A dirt road ran along the foot of the eastern slope of the ridge east of Swift Creek. The wagon convoy followed it 5-6 miles north until they came to a trail cutting it at right angles. The convoy halted. Sergeant Sales and Scout Dawkins rode to the top of the ridge. On the far side in the valley below, Swift Creek widened, becoming more shallow, its current slowing. It was a broad, flat, lazy bend, gently twisting and bending. Downstream at Flat Bridge, it had been dark blue, but here it was greenish-brown.
Mesa's Ford.
There was a mounted man on the east bank, and a man on foot with a horse nearby on the west.
Those two are mine. I sent them on ahead to make sure there's no surprises waiting for us.
Sales took off his hat and waved it over his head. The man on the near side of the ford held a rifle in one hand, pumping it up and down in the air several times in response.
Looks okay. Let's go down and make sure.
He and Dawkins rode down to the creek. The ground was thick with tall grass, rushes, willow trees. Everything was green and moist. Small streams and rivulets webbed the flat, tufts and hummocks thrusting up between them. There was a smell of damp earth and water. The air was a little hazy. The trail was hard-packed, but not as easy as it had been on the slope. It ran right straight to the water's edge. A man in a cavalry uniform sat his horse near the creek. He had narrow eyes and a close-cropped blue-black beard. His jacket was unbuttoned and open, and he sat slouching in the saddle. Sales and Dawkins reined in, facing him.
Dawkins? Corporal Reese. Dawkins is a scout for the convoy. How's it look, Reese?
Okay, Sarge.
No Comanches?
Ain't seen an engine all day.
Well, you won't see them until they lift your scalp.
I still got my hair and so does Fenner, so I guess we're in the clear.
Good.
The creek was about 50 feet wide here. Sales put a hand on the side of his mouth.
Okay on your end, Fenner?
All set, Sarge.
Hell, he sounds like a Johnny Reb.
He was. He's been galvanized.
Sales used the term for a former Confederate soldier who'd been recruited into the service of the Union.
The Army don't much care who's fighting the Comanches as long as they get the job done. As for Fenner, he likes eating regular, even if it is Yankee mess hall chow.
Sales turned to Reese.
Button up that tunic and get yourself squared away. It's time to start looking like a soldier. We got us first lieutenant who's all spit and polish.
Yes, sir.
Sales' face clouded. His expression, always stony, was now glowering.
Don't call me sir, you dumb son of a bitch. I'm no officer. Get some more with me and I'll kick your butt so hard your tailbone will be coming out the top of your head.
That wiped the smirk off of Reese's face. He straightened up in the saddle.
Sorry, Sarge.
Shut up. Never mind, you've been up all night and day chasing engines. We gotta show the lieutenant something.
Sales faced Dawkins.
You can tell Greer it's safe to make the crossing.
All right.
And make it quick. There's a Comanche war party on the loose, and we're still a long way off from Fort Pardee.
Dawkins nodded. He turned his horse, riding uphill, disappearing on the other side of the ridge. Presently, the convoy came into view, descending the trail to the creek. Lieutenant Greer rode at the head of the column of armed guards, followed by the wagon. The horses could see and smell the water. Some of them got antsy, nostrils flaring, ears twitching. They had to be held in. Sales rode over to Lieutenant Greer and saluted.
My men have scouted the area, sir. Way is clear.
Greer acknowledged the report with a curt nod.
Thank you, Sergeant.
One of his men rode up.
It's been a long, dry journey, sir. The horses could use some water.
Get them across the creek first. I want to make the crossing as soon as possible. We've already lost too much time thanks to this detour. Once we're on the other side, we'll water the animals. But don't let them drink too much. I don't want them swelled up so they slow us down.
Yes, sir.
He went to pass the word to the rest of the men. The convoy started across the creek, horses kicking up little splashes and spumes of water. The stream was less than 3 feet deep at its center, and much shallower for most of its width. A mild current swirled around the horses and wagon, chuckling and purling. A light breeze lifted, rustling through the rushes, making them wave their tops. Crossings are always a bit disordered. The line got stretched out, making a noisy hubbub. The wagon's harness team lurched forward, heaving and pulling. The horses wanted to stop and drink. The driver handling the traces fought them. The wagon bounced and jostled on its springs. Even at midstream, the water level was well below the bottom of the wagon bed. Sergeant Sales rode alongside Lieutenant Greer.
Hey, Lieutenant!
Greer glanced his way, turning a cold eye on the non-com.
What is it, Sergeant?
I want to tell you something.
Yes?
There's one thing I hate, it's officers.
Sales shot Greer in the side. The lieutenant crumpled like he was imploding, shrinking into himself. Sales pumped a slug into the officer's belly. Greer fell sideways off his horse into the water. Sales' opening shots were a signal, triggering an answering fusillade from both sides of the creek, where gunmen were hidden in the tall grass. The murderous volley took out a number of the wagon's escort riders.
Amboy! Bushwhackers!
On the far bank, Fenner swung his rifle up and shot the guard nearest him off his horse. Dawkins clawed for his pistol, fumbling with the top flap of the holster. Before it could clear leather, Sales shot the top of his head off. The shotgun rider on the wagon swung his weapon up. Riding up from behind, Reese shot him in the back. The shotgunner's dying spasm caused him to jerk both double triggers at once, discharging a shattering blast to the side that caught two more mounted guards, peppering them ragged with shot. 7 ambushers lurked on the west bank, 4 on the east. They popped up from behind rocks and trees, potting away at the guards fording the creek. The wagon driver jerked and shuddered under the impact of slug after slug ripping into him from different directions. Sales emptied his revolver into nearby wagon guards, burning them down. He clutched the reins tightly in his other fist, holding the horse's head down, wheeling it this way and that in search of new targets. Reese was on the opposite side of the column, gunning down guards. The hammer of Sales' gun clicked on empty chambers. The gun dropped from his hand as he freed it to shuck the rifle out of his saddle scabbard. He bit down, holding the reins between his teeth as he worked the long-levered gun with both hands. Something tugged at his tunic below his right arm, a slug passing through. It came not from a wagon guard, but rather from one of the shooters on the far bank. Sales didn't see who it was.
Son of a...
A guard rider wheeled, breaking for the east bank. Sales leveled the rifle and shot him off his horse. The rider's foot snagged in the stirrup, causing him to be dragged a short distance before the corpse tumbled free on shore. The horse kept running. It was all over in a minute or two. A passel of riderless horses milled about in the creek. Sales guided his horse a half dozen paces upstream.
Cease firing!
The shooting did not stop at once, but raggedly died down. Bodies bobbed, floating face down in the water, the gentle tug of the current starting to move them downstream. A pall of gun smoke hung over the ford. Random shots continued to erupt from both banks of the creek.
Stop shooting, you sons of bitches!
Reese rode up alongside the wagon, transferring to it from his horse. The shotgunner had fallen out, but the driver lay sprawled across the seat. Reese planted a booted foot against the driver's side and push-kicked him into the water. Plunking down into the driver's seat, he gathered up the traces and took control of the team.
Get the wagon across to the other side!
Okay, Brock!
Sergeant Ben Sales was an alias. There was a real Sergeant Sales on the rolls at Fort Pardee, but the man calling the shots wasn't him. The man was Brock Harper, one of the most dangerous bandit chiefs west of the Mississippi, or east of it, for that matter. Hailing from California, he'd shot his way across the map to surface in Hangtree County, Texas. Reese was no alias. It was the phony corporal's real name, but it was his Christian name, not his surname. His full name was Reese Kimbrough, better known as Killer Kimbrough. Killer Kimbrough was the name bannered on the many wanted posters and circulars bearing his likeness that were papered throughout Texas and the Southwest. Luckily, the drawing accompanying them was generic enough to fit any one of 1,000 men. Kimbrough was Harper's trusted aide, his right-hand man. The shooters on both sides of the creek began emerging from their places of concealment. They were a rough bunch, robbers and killers, armed with rifles, shotguns, and six guns. Fenner took off his hat and waved it over his head. A mixed bag made up this gang of bushwhackers. Some southerners, some northerners. They were a couple of Mexicans, several persons of mixed blood, a full-blooded Kiowa Indian, a Canadian, and even one transplanted Australian. They shared a common lust for gold and, at best, an indifference to taking human life to get it. At best. Some of them like to kill for the pure fun of it. Kimbrough drove the wagon across the creek up onto the west bank, reining the team to a halt.
Some of you men get in the water and keep those bodies from drifting too far downstream.
Harper turned in the saddle, facing the east bank. Four men stood there, holding rifles and shotguns whose muzzles still trailed strings and wisps of gun smoke.
You bastards have to get wet crossing back over anyhow, so make yourselves useful and corral those deaders. Move!
Quartet splashed into the creek to obey. Blood colored the water. Swirling, spiraling clouds of the red stuff spread among the strata of green and brown water. The creek grew murkier than ever due to the horse hooves and wagon wheels churning up the bottom during the action. The outlaws took hold of floating corpses, herding them to shore. Brock Harper rode up onto the west bank. It was thickly wooded. The trail resumed at the water's edge and continued west, making a tunnel through the brush. Farther down the trail, around a bend and out of sight of anyone crossing the ford from the east bank, lay a clearing. The gang's horses were hidden there, tethered and watched by two men designated as horse holders. Nothing was more embarrassing or potentially fatal than having horses run off when their riders were dismounted. A flatbed wagon hitched to a four-horse team sat hidden around the bend, too. Fenner was gangly, thin-faced, with long, lank hair, sunken eyes, and buck teeth. He went to Harper.
Well, hey! What a turkey shoot! Did the feathers fly high? What?
Harper held a flap of his blue tunic out and away from himself, showing a bullet hole.
One of you jackasses almost shot me. It came from over here. Who did it?
Nobody stepped forward to own up. Fenner snickered, wiping his nose with the back of his hand.
Must be that blue uniform, boss. Folks just naturally like to shoot at it. Can't blame them for it.
Think it's so funny you'd be laughing out the other side of your mouth if I get a notion to straighten you out.
Or me, Brock. If I was shooting at you, I wouldn't have missed. Not that I ever would.
You're damn right about that, you Ozark peckerwood.
Harper swung down out of the saddle. Relieved of his weight, his horse seemed to gain several inches in height. The empty holster at his hip nagged at him.
Somebody give me a gun.
Most of the gang carried more than one six-gun.
Here you go, Brock.
Thanks.
Harper checked to make sure it was loaded. He took nothing on faith. Loaded it was. He waited in his hand, checking the balance. His test shot knocked a pine cone off a tree. The gun passed muster. Harper stuffed it into his empty holster and looked around, his eye falling on the nearest of his men.
Wills, Gordy, Digger, Martin, mount up and round up those army horses. They're loot, and even gets away, it's like throwing away money.
The four went down the trail to the clearing around the bend to get their horses. Harper shucked off the blue tunic, throwing it to the ground.
Whew, feels good to be rid of that. As tight as a sausage skin.
Reese Kimbrough shook his head.
You just about busted out of the seams.
We were lucky to get those uniforms at all, thanks to our inside man at Fort Pardee. They don't hardly field troopers in my size.
No, they don't, and that's a fact.
That reminds me. Where's the lieutenant?
The one you gut shot? Somewhere in with the rest of them.
Harper headed for the creek. Savage Texas is continued on the next CD.